Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but just don't worry.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to start our program today looking at chocolate, wine, and berries, and how they can protect you against type 2 diabetes. And then how vitamin B3 and fiber protects against colon cancer and inflammation, which tens of millions of Americans have in their gut. And then a really large trial supports echinacea's immune benefits. That's good. And how higher amounts of vitamin D can be related to a lower risk of depression, and a lot more on health and healing. Then from our environmental segment, did the federal government open up 400,000 acres of land in California to frack in the middle of a water crisis? Yeah, not good. We'll talk about that. Also, and you know, we've been hearing about earthquakes associated with the amount of fracking. Well, it's true. In fact, we have a report that we're going to share with you from the University of Colorado Boulder in the United States Geological Survey. They analyzed data from earthquakes in more than 106,000 active injection wells across the central and the eastern part of the United States. It's the largest study to date, and they found, quote, the entire increase in the number of earthquakes in the United States mid-continent is associated with injection wells, end quote. So, no longer can they say there's no consequence to the environment. Yeah, there is. Earthquakes. Now the question is, when you have so many wells in a given area and you have so many earthquakes in a given area, is it just a matter of time before you get a big earthquake? We'll talk about that. Also today, we're going to take a look at new information about what may be behind the drive in California to give mandated vaccines. A hint? Well, how about the industry, the drug industry, the pharmaceutical industry? The vaccine industry gave more than $2 million to current lawmakers, and that could be a big motivation. And also, there's a call for investigation into payments to Dr. Pan and Dr. Atkins, and this goes out to the Attorney General in California. Also today, I'll be continuing with a commentary looking at fascism in the United States. We'll be hearing something really rare today. The last words of Orwell. And I think you'll find it interesting. The final interview before he died. Now, mind you, that's a long time ago. Few people have ever heard it, what his words were. And then I'm going to follow that with Alan Watts, because he was right in sync with this. And then from Professor Henry Giroux from Truthout about fascism. We have a lot of things to talk about. Let's get started. First up, I always like to talk about things that can help us. Now, our immune system functions year-round, not just when it's cold or there is inclement weather. But you can have a stress against your immune system at any time. If you're overworking, under resting, your immune system is affected. If you have a lot of saturated proteins and carbohydrates, your immune system is also affected. If you're under stress, emotional stress, your immune system is affected. So any time that we can do something that's natural and non-toxic to help our immune system, that's a good thing. Well, we have now seen a really definitive look in a big trial of patients exhibiting flu symptoms for less than 48 hours indicated that echinacea made the difference. The study performed by researchers at the Czech Republic, Germany, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom was held, quote, as yet another significant human trial that helps to document the clinical benefits of this specific echinacea. And that is important. And that was from Mark Blumenthal, Executive Director of the American Botanical Council. Quote, It is rewarding to see an herbal extract that has such important phytotherapeutic benefits. So, for those of you who want to have a stronger immune system, who may not be rested, may be stressed, maybe you want to detox, echinacea, and it can help. Also, what can help us against disease, and we've already seen it helps against diabetes, helps prevent an age from the brain from aging, is chocolate. But according to King's College London, as well as the University of East Anglia in the United Kingdom, wine, meaning red wine, and berries help against type 2 diabetes. Quote from King's College London, "Good news for chocolate and wine lovers. New research suggests that consuming high levels of flavonoids found in foods such as chocolate, tea, berries, and wine may help protect against type 2 diabetes. This was published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Nutrition." Quote, "Investigators from King's College London and the University of East Anglia, both in the United Kingdom, say their research shows that a high intake of these dietary compounds is linked to reduced insulin resistance and improved glucose regulation." Well, this audience knows that type 2 diabetes, the most common form of diabetes, is caused by insulin resistance. That means your body is unable to use insulin properly, which can lead to abnormal blood glucose or blood sugar levels. And to reach these findings, they did a large study of 1,997 female volunteers, 18 years old to 78, and they followed them, and they saw the anthocyanins, the flavonones, the flavin-3-ols, the polymeric flavonoids, all of these that you get from onions and garlic and blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, cherries, and they found in grapes, quote, "Flavonoids reduce insulin resistance and inflammation." So this is very important, because think of all the women in the United States today and around the world, because we're heard all over the world, that have prediabetes or diabetes, and just shifting over to a healthy diet can make the difference. We have a lot of depressed people in the United States for a lot of reasons. One of them is not brain chemical imbalance, as the manufacturers of those drugs would like you to believe. This is from investigators in the National Institutes of Health, and this is a report that shows that, quote, "higher serum 5-hydroxy vitamin D concentrations are related to a reduced risk of depression." And this was published in Clinical Trials Week. So what it means is this: we're not getting enough vitamin D. We're not getting enough sunshine, because when people are in the sun, they generally put so much of the sunblock on that the vitamin D can't get through, or they don't get enough sun when they do go out on enough parts of their body, and hence they've got the problem. So taking vitamin D3 in your diet is the best way of doing it, especially if you're in a blue mood or feeling depressed. Also, vitamin B3, that's niacin, and fiber protects against colon cancer and inflammation. Now, this is from George Regent University. Quote, and this is a big study. Previous research has suggested that a diet rich in fiber may reduce the risk of colon inflammation and cancer. But new research suggests that niacin, also known as vitamin B3, may also protect against these conditions. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Immunity. And quote, niacin was able to make a difference. Immune cell receptive to activation by fiber digestion. So in lay language, if you want to help protect yourself against polyps, inflammation, colorectal cancer, any of the itises, ileitis, colitis, spastic colon, Crohn's disease, make sure you're getting plenty of quality soft fibers. The soft fibers would be from, well, apple pectin, blueberries, strawberries. Those are outstanding. Banana fiber is terrific. and then also have some of the seed and nut fibers. That really does a cleansing on your gut. Also, this is an interesting study from University College London, and here's what it has to say. It says, people who enjoy life maintain better physical function in daily activities and have faster walking speeds as they age. So, what it comes down to, based upon this study, and this was a study over 8 years, and they divided the participants to do different things, people who are happier and enjoy life age slower. People are unhappy and stressed, always relying upon someone else to be the missing part of their love or their security. They age faster, have more diseases, complain more, and almost always look at the negative in anything. They find always a reason to justify their pessimism and their negative energy. No matter where you put these people, they're going to find a reason not to be happy there. But people who are happy, people who are easy to get along with, people who flow through a day, people who exercise and try to make healthy choices in their life, they live a longer life. And finally, the increased intake of the long-chain omega-3 fatty acids reduced the risk of diabetes. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Diabetes Care, and here's what it says. Quote, higher serum concentrations of long-chain omega-3 fatty acids could help reduce the risk of developing type 2 diabetes by up to 33%, according to a population study. And this was done at the University of Eastern Finland. So, the takeaway message, if you have avocados or flaxseed or walnuts, you're getting omega-3 fatty acids. Or if you have flaxseed oil, you're getting omega-3 fatty acids. That reduces your impact overall. And we need that impact reduced on diabetes. So two things help us with diabetes today. Let me just slip one more in real quick because it's an important one. This is published in the peer-reviewed journal Mycopathology, which showed that oil of lemon can be used as a very effective natural remedy against candidiasis caused by C. albicans. So the essential oil of lemon, which most people have never heard of, is good against candida yeast infections. And we've known that for a long time. But it's good to see that people are still doing studies. Now, one of the things we could do is take the juice of 2 lemons and a green tea in the morning, and that would make a big impact upon candida. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about tangerines can protect against a long list of chronic illnesses and how aluminum intake leads to dementia and where silicate intake decreases dementia. Have a lot to share on that tomorrow. Now let's take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to take a look at some of the environmental issues that we're facing. Please stay with us. Screening up in Woodstock on Saturday evening. It was followed by a nearly 3-hour lecture I gave to a wonderful group of people, lots of activists, in support of WIOF 104.1 FM that serves just the Woodstock area. It's a small station, but they're doing good work. I was happy to be able to be up there, and it was a fundraiser for them, and we raised some money for them. So I want to thank all the people that showed up. Now, and all the people who showed up last week, what a wonderful group we had, impassioned, empowered, energized, to the world premiere of Saving the Planet last week at the Theater Manhattan, and a good group of people. So I'm thankful you all showed up. Saw some people I hadn't seen in years, even in decades there. And I have one more showing middle of next month out in Long Island, Huntington Arts Cinema. Now to our environmental segment. This is from Rebecca Kern, Courthouse News. This is from Los Angeles. Quote, the federal and state governments illegally opened up 400,000 acres for fracking in Southern California, which already has thousands of such dangerous oil and gas wells. Environmentalists claim in court. The Center for Biological Diversity and the Los Pedros Forest Watch sued the Bureau of Land Management, the Secretary of the Interior, and the Director of California's Bureau of Land Management in federal court. They claimed the government violated the National Environmental Policy Act by approving fracking without proper environmental analysis. Quote, long-term business-as-usual oil and gas development in Central California, which is what the federal government has approved here, facilitates the expansion of high-impact unconventional extraction techniques like fracking in a region already overburdened by oil and gas activities, polluted air, extreme water scarcity, and landscape degradation. The federal government has ignored these realities and turned its back on California's environmental health in approving this plan. The law requires better. Now, this audience knows that fracking involves high-pressure injection of water and chemicals into shale rock to fracture the formation and extract oil and gas. And environmentalists say it can pollute groundwater, which it does, and even cause earthquakes, which I also today showed that it did. And homeowners in some areas near fracking operations are really adversely affected. And this is on top of the idea that you're running out of water in California. But they seem to have no resistance of allowing the special polluting industries to do business. And also from our environmental segment, new work adds to scientific consensus that earthquake surge in Texas and Oklahoma stem from wastewater injection wells. So what this says, and this is from Inside Climate News, from Zara Hirji, the surge in earthquakes, which have been thousands of them in Oklahoma and Texas and other parts of the nation's midsection, are likely caused by millions of gallons of toxic oil and gas wastewater being disposed of underground, and that's two separate studies that have shown that. And so Stanford University also discovered the greater seismic activity in certain counties in Oklahoma, preceded by a 1,000% increase in the volume of wastewater injected. And these were published in the journal Science Advances. So one more reason to ban all gas hydrofracking in all states. Also, I want to break several little segments up now because I think it's important. Since we only want a temporary 24-hour reprieve of fast-tracking the Trans-Pacific Partnership legislation from occurring, that's all it was. It was just a reprieve. They're right back at it again with corporate Democrats and Republicans working with the president to make sure that their Trans-Pacific Partnership gets through. Now, there's two perspectives on this from the Democrats. One is from Elizabeth Warren. One is from Hillary Clinton. Let's hear what Elizabeth Warren, has to say about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. We'll listen for about 3 minutes.
Mr. President, the United States is in the final stages of negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a massive free trade agreement with Mexico, Canada, Japan, Singapore, and 7 other countries. And I come to the floor today to ask a fundamental question. Who will benefit from the TPP? American workers, consumers, small businesses, taxpayers, or the biggest multinational corporations in the world? One strong hand is buried down in the fine print of the closely guarded draft. The provision, an increasingly common feature of international trade agreements, is called Investor Dispute Settlement, or ISDS. Now, the name may sound mild, but this provision fundamentally tilts the playing field further in favor of big multinational corporations. Worse yet, it undermines U.S. sovereignty. ISDS allows foreign companies to challenge American laws and potentially pick up huge payouts from taxpayers without ever stepping foot in an American court. Now, here's how it works. Imagine that the United States bans a toxic chemical that is often added to gasoline. We ban it because we believe it is dangerous for people's health or harmful to the environment. If a foreign company that makes this toxic chemical wants to sell it in the U.S., it would normally have to challenge that in a U.S. court. But with ISDS, the company could skip the U.S. court and go before an international panel of arbitrators. If the company wins, the ruling cannot be challenged in U.S. courts, and the arbitration panel could require the American taxpayers to cough up millions, even billions of dollars in damages. ISDS has the power to impose gigantic fines, but it doesn't have independent judges. Instead, highly paid corporate lawyers go back and forth between representing corporations one day and sitting in judgment of corporations the next. Now, I don't know. Maybe that makes sense in an arbitration between two corporations, but not in cases between corporations and governments. We should have real doubts about how likely it is that a lawyer looking to attract high-paying corporate clients will rule against those corporations when it's his or her turn to sit in the judge's seat. It's also a real problem that only international investors, get to use these courts. Investors that are, by and large, large corporations. If a Vietnamese company with American operations wants to challenge an increase in the U.S. minimum wage, it can use ISDS. But if an American labor union believes the Vietnamese companies are paying slave labor wages in violation of trade commitments, the union has to try to wind itself through the Vietnamese courts. Good luck with that. These rigged pseudo-courts were created after World War II because investors worried about putting money into developing countries where the legal systems were just not as dependable. They were concerned that a corporation might build a plant today only to watch a dictator confiscate it tomorrow. ISDS was born to encourage foreign investment in countries with weak legal systems. Now, look, I don't know if these justifications made sense back then, but they sure don't make sense now. Countries in the TPP are hardly emerging economies with weak legal systems. Australia and Japan have well-developed, well-respected legal systems, and multinational corporations navigate those legal systems every single day. But ISDS would preempt their courts, too. And to the extent there are countries that are riskier politically, market competition can solve that problem. Countries that respect property rights and the rule of law, like the United States, should be more competitive. And if a company wants to invest in a country with a weak legal system, then it should buy political risk insurance, which is available. The use of ISDS is on the rise. From 1959 to 2002, there were fewer than 100 ISDS claims worldwide. But by 2012 alone, there were 58 cases. That's in 1 year. Here are some examples of recent cases under various treaties with ISDS provisions. A French company sued Egypt because Egypt raised its minimum wage. A Swedish company sued Germany because Germany decided to phase out nuclear power after the Fukushima disaster. A Dutch company sued the Czech Republic because the Czech Republic didn't bail out a bank that the Dutch company partially owned. And American corporations are getting in on the action, too. Philip Morris is trying to use ISDS to stop Uruguay from implementing new tobacco regulations aimed at cutting.
Now, that's Senator Elizabeth Warren showing why she is against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. On the other side, every statement, only now, of course, from Hillary Clinton, is very vague, that we should look at it carefully. What does that mean? That we should make sure that it represents our interests. What does that mean? We shouldn't have this treaty at all. It's a bad treaty. It has been negotiated in total secret and written by over 500 special interest groups, none of them legislators in the United States. And so they actually wanted to keep it in secret, the content of the actual legislation, for 5 years after it was implemented. What kind of law would you agree is a good law that no one can know its contents for 5 years after it's written? Here's what Clinton, had the people done their homework, would have discovered. She has talked about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And here's what Jake Tapper from CNN has found. On 45 separate occasions, Secretary Clinton pushed the Trans-Pacific Partnership she now says she has concern about. Now, mind you, now that she's a candidate, she wants to gain as many Democrat or progressive votes as possible. And so she'll say anything. But go back to her actual record. On the record, January 31st, 2013, remarks on American leadership at the Council on Foreign Relations. And that's a whole group that should be investigated thoroughly. Quote, first and foremost, the so-called pivot has been about creative diplomacy, like signing a little noted treaty and cooperation with Asian that countries that opened the door to permanent representation and ultimately elevated a form of engaging on high-stakes issues like the South China Sea. And goes on to talk about how she, quote, we've used trade negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership to find common ground with former adversary in Vietnam, and the list goes on, end quote. That's her statement. January 18, 2013, remarks with Japanese foreign minister, quote, we also discussed the Trans-Pacific Partnership and we shared perspectives on Japan's possible participation. In November 29, 2012, remarks at the Foreign Policy Group's Transformational Trends 2013 forum, quote, let me offer five big-ticket agenda items that we absolutely have to get right as well. And one of them, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, 100% behind it. November 17, 2012. Again, November 15, 2012, remarks at the tech port in Australia. Quote, we need to keep upping our game, both bilaterally and with partners across the region through agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. November 4, 2012, remarks with the Australian Prime Minister, Robert Carr, and about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that we should work together. Now, all told, there are 45 separate meetings where we have her on the record, quoted verbatim, supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Not in one single situation has she had any opposition to it. Now that she's being challenged, now that she realizes that her historical base is not supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership, she's trying to find a way around it by vague language. But if you ask her, will you vote against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, will reject the Trans-Pacific Partnership, she won't answer that. So you got to understand what you're dealing with. Now, to those in this audience who support Hillary Clinton, and it's you're certainly right to support her, do you know what the difference between her and Jeb Bush are? Well, I'd like to tell you 10 reasons they're the same. And this is from Jake Anderson from Anti-Media. Number one, they're virtually identical on the major issues poisoning our republic. They have both blatantly corrupt corporate ties. And if you read any of the articles about the super PACs and the money that goes to the Clinton Foundation and for them to do $400,000 and $500,000 speeches about nothing, that's all payback. And Jeb Bush actually consulted 15 companies, seven of them for profits. And but we know, when you're paid $15,000 a month to be on the board of a company and you're on 10 different companies, that's a whole lot of money per month. And these are multinational corporations. And did you forget that Hillary Clinton was for 6 years, she was a director of Walmart? Why hasn't anyone ask her, well, during your 6 years, why didn't you advocate for better living wages? There's no living wage at Walmart. And in fact, during that time, she helped Walmart fight aggressively to destroy union activity. Why isn't that ever held up by the unions? Are they that ignorant of this fact? Or are they simply fearful that if she is president, they still want to have some access to her? In either case, she was anti-union, is anti-union. She showed her colors most spectacularly by hiring a former Monsanto lobbyist to run her campaign. She's also exceedingly cozy with some of the more corrupt Wall Street entities. And just look at the Clinton Foundation, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, $1 million contributions. Why? They both are major war hawks. Just take a look at the military-industrial complex, and you will see Clinton doesn't even try to disguise her support for ongoing war. Her complete embrace of what is called, quote, destructive nationalistic myths has earned her the label of war hawk, a moniker is well-deserved. And she was a vocal supporter of the Second Iraq War in 2003, despite the lack of any evidence that military action was necessary. And she certainly was in a position with all of the stay-behinds. By the way, a stay-behind is someone that when you're in a top office, you hire, who becomes a permanent part of the establishment, and that becomes a basis for feeding you information if you need it and keeping your policies or your secrets in the pocket or being there as a future advocate on your behalf. And keep in mind, because of that support, not just of hers, but all the other people that supported that, there are over 1 million dead Iraqis and over 4 million displaced. There's never apology. And despite finally admitting her vote for war was a mistake, she pushed the next war, which was in Libya, and was adamant. And now take a look. Libya is not just a failed state. It is the ultimate hotbed, along with Somalia, for terrorist activity, thriving. And yet it wasn't before. She's responsible for that, because had she been against the United States supporting of NATO and England and France and Germany going in there, it wouldn't have happened. But she was an advocate. Also, Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush both support the Patriot Act and the National Security Agency mass surveillance. And in fact, they have supported it the day it was secretly drafted, only days after 9/11. And this unconstitutional bill granted the government unprecedented powers of civilian detainment, as well as access to private data. And in fact, no one has challenged her on would she deconstruct the 17 major intelligence agencies and reestablish habeas corpus? Would she dismantle the National Defense Authorization Act or the Patriot Act? She is a super war hawk. They both support hydrofracking. So once again, how could any environmentalist support a candidate that supports fracking? And in fact, during a keynote speech at the National Clean Energy Summit, Clinton made it clear she wanted strong regulations on fracking, but as Secretary of State, she was responsible for promoting the practice in countries like Bulgaria, which are unlikely to enforce any regulations. And they both support the drug war. How many people are in jail because of her husband's policies? How many families have been destroyed? And what has it gained us? Last year, we spent $3.6 billion busting and prosecuting people for pot possession. That ruined their lives over what, a natural herb that has never caused a death, that is more beneficial for brain cancer than any chemotherapy or radiation? And both Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton aggressively support big banks, and they believe in bailing them out. And remember, Bill Clinton, in his presidency, moved to dismantle the Glass-Steagall Act, undoing the regulation of derivatives, and his henchman on the repeal was former Goldman Sachs Robert Rubin. And perhaps unsurprisingly, Hillary Clinton has repeatedly signaled she will not change course on financial regulation. In fact, in 2013, Goldman Sachs paid her $400,000 for a speech in which she said that progressives and their anti-Walmart rhetoric are, quote, foolish. But why doesn't anyone call her out? Meanwhile, the Bush family has a long and sickening history of colluding with big banks, starting with George H.W. Bush running a deregulation task force with a former Merrill Lynch CEO. And then they also both support Monsanto and GMOs. And in fact, Clinton is one of the biggest supporters of Monsanto in the country. And they both spend billions on the upcoming election, and they both support the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. So, where is there any mystery? There isn't. And yet, think of how many people will vote for her because she's a woman. Well, it's fine to have a woman for any office, providing that she is the most qualified person and will represent everyone's interest. But we know whose interest she will represent. And yet, the left will not give a forum to the true independent progressives, and they won't be invited to the debates. They'll be excluded. And it's too bad, because we need greater voices for the people in these debates. And just something that I'm going to be doing more on, a special program, according to Robert Harrington of Natural News, Suboxone, the psych drug, is behind the Charleston church shootings, and it's a powerful psychoactive drug, which is utilized in breaking heroin and narcotic pain-relieving addictions. And just like methadone, Suboxone has its downside risks and adverse effects. It is a medication which contains two primary ingredients, and these ingredients are synthetic opiates, and that drug blocks the feelings of euphoria. So you get on these, you can go homicidal. Why isn't this being discussed? So we have done the research, we've done the scholarship, and we will have a program in the next 2 weeks showing you that every mass murderer in the United States and around the world has been on these psychiatric drugs, and yet not a mention about that. I'm Gary Knoll. Also coming up, a special investigative report on how many nutritionists or nutrition experts have been bought off by the big junk food companies. You'll be surprised. I'll be naming names and giving you a background on who bought them. I'll give you the Coca-Cola, Nestle's, Hershey's, Monsanto, Cargill, and other food giants, and control the studies that get funded and published, steering researchers toward projects that benefit the industry while silencing research that doesn't. So we'll deal with that on an upcoming program. It's just coming at you. Now we're going to go over and we're going to hear Alan Watts talk about what George Orwell and Aldous Huxley both feared.
Why is it that we don't seem to be able to adjust ourselves to the physical environment without destroying it? Why is it that in a way this culture represents in a unique fashion the law of diminishing returns, that our success is a failure, that we are building up, in other words, an enormous technological civilization which seems to promise the fulfillment of every wish almost at the touch of a button. And yet, as in so many fairy tales, when the wishes finally materialize, they're like fairy gold. They're not really material at all. In other words, so many of our products, our cars, our homes, our clothing, our food, it looks as if it were really the instant creation of pure thought. That is to say, it is thoroughly insubstantial, lacking in what the connoisseur of wine calls body. And in so many other ways, the riches that we produce are ephemeral. And as a result of that, we're frustrated. We're terribly frustrated. We feel that the only thing is to go on getting more and more. And as a result of that, the whole landscape begins to look like the nursery of a spoiled child who's got too many toys and is bored with them and throws them away as fast as he gets them, plays them for a few minutes. Also, we're dedicated to a tremendous war on the material, the basic material dimensions of time and space. We want to obliterate their limitations. We want to get everything done as fast as possible. We want to convert the rhythms and the skills of work into cash, which indeed you can buy something with, but you can't eat it. And then rush home to get away from work and begin the real business of life, to enjoy ourselves. You know, for the vast majority of American families, what seems to be the real point of life, what you rush home to get to, is to watch an electronic reproduction of life. You can't touch it. It doesn't smell, and it has no taste. You might think that people getting home to the real point of life in a robust material culture would go home to a colossal banquet or an orgy of lovemaking or a riot of music and dancing, but nothing of the kind. It turns out to be this purely passive contemplation of a twittering screen. You see mile after mile of darkened houses with that little electronic screen flickering in the room. Everybody isolated, watching this thing, and thus in no real communion with each other at all. And this isolation of people into a private world of their own is really the creation of a mindless crowd. And so, we don't get with each other, except for public expressions of getting rid of our hostility, like football or prize fighting. And even in the spectacles one sees on this television, it's perfectly proper to exhibit people slugging and slaying each other, but oh dear no, not people loving each other, except in a rather restrained way. One can only draw the conclusion that the assumption underlying this is that expressions of physical love are far more dangerous than expressions of physical hatred. And it seems to me that a culture that has that sort of assumption is basically crazy and devoted, unintentionally indeed, but nevertheless in fact devoted, not to survival, but to the actual destruction of life.
And that was Alan Watts. Now, a short 2-minute clip, the last comments of George Orwell before he passed, and see how relevant that is today, all these decades later.
But he left one final warning.
1984 is, I believe, a quite terrifying masterpiece. So terrifying, in fact, I don't think I should like to read another like it.
I am not absolutely dissatisfied with it. I think it is a good idea, but the execution would have been better if I had not been under the influence of TB when I wrote it.
You once claimed that you have an ability to face unpleasant facts. Is that what you've demonstrated in 1984 by drawing an accurate portrait of the future?
I think that allowing for the book being, after all, a parody, something like 1984 could actually happen. This is the direction the world is going in at the present time. In our world, there will be no emotions except fear, rage, triumph, and self-abasement. The sex instinct will be eradicated. We shall abolish the orgasm. There will be no loyalty except loyalty to the party. But always, there will be the intoxication of power. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. The moral to be drawn from this dangerous nightmare situation is a simple one. Don't let it happen. It depends on you.
And yet we have allowed it to happen. Think of what he said, he is right. And a special commentary, if time permits, today, if not tomorrow. But I also want to introduce something today for all of the listeners, of which there are tens of thousands to this program in California, who are awake and fighting the state and the corporate interest of the state and the corruption within the state of mandatory vaccines. Now, I support any vaccine, and I've said this in the beginning, I will support any vaccine that can be shown to be safe and effective for every person. And if you can provide the research from independent science, then I would certainly endorse that. But when we look carefully, we do not find that there is safety and efficacy. There's lies, there's cover-ups. Now we have whistleblowers, we have people coming forward, and we have scientists and physicians, Sherry Tenpenny and others, Nancy Banks, showing we've all been lied to. Joining us is a person who spent a lot of time researching this, thousands of hours. He is our scholar in residence, Richard Gale. And Richard and I together have authored over 50 articles, all fully documented, all fully vetted, and they're on our website. In fact, we just reposted them today on all topics, including over 34 on vaccines. And Richard and I just completed an article that is up there, two articles, part one and part two, on challenging their idea that that we should be pro-vaccine because the vaccine helped end the smallpox that Jenner invented, and then the vaccine that ended the polio, which was Jonas Salk, and neither of which is historically accurate if you do your homework. And we broke down the whole history and the epidemiology and the science to show both of those are myths. And we've published them, and they've been accepted by some very prestigious and highly respected publications and disseminated throughout the world. He's here now to give us some new information on why all the people in California should be very concerned about the drug companies donating millions of dollars to California lawmakers before vaccine debate. Nice to have you with us, Richard.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be on.
Richard's on Skype. Richard, tell us what you have found and what is the latest research that the drug companies have been filling the bank accounts of California politicians, who then turn around and say this is a good idea to have mandatory vaccines with no exemptions.
Well, the main piece of this was a reporter from the Sacramento Bee in California who did some excellent investigation. It's rare for the Sacramento's major newspaper, and uncovered that Richard Penn, the senator who's been promoting these draconian vaccine bills in the California Senate, and his co-sponsor of the bill, have both received far more money from the drug industry than was being thought. Penn has received up to $95,000 from them, and the co-sponsor has received $90,000. That's more than any other acting senator in the California legislature who's received money from the big pharma. So there's clearly an incentive that, there's certainly much more behind it than we probably, that we don't even know yet. But he's become the henchman now to really promote a lot of big pharma's interests throughout California. And these vaccine bills are just one of them right now. This is a video you could see on YouTube. Pan, when he gave testimony to the assembly in California, was asked directly whether vaccines had aborted fetal cells. And he called it a lie, and he said that it was a myth that is promulgated that vaccines do not have aborted fetal cells. So we could just look at this. There is, if you go to the CDC's own website, and they have a wonderful site and it gives all the ingredients of every vaccine out there, you find in current vaccines there is in the MMR, for example, you'll see something called a W138. Well, what's that? That's a diploid human cell. It's a fibroblast that was taken from the lung tissue of a three-month-old fetus. Okay, so that's being used in all your MMRs. If you look at the DTaP, the DTaP, or the adenovirus vaccine, there is what you see, MRC5 cell line. Okay, now this was a cell line. It was created back in 1966, still used today, from the lung tissue of a 14-week fetus that was aborted by a woman who happened to be in a psychiatric ward. But, and this is, you know, he came out directly saying that there are no aborted fetal cells used in vaccines. And, of course, if you have legislators listening to this, and they know they're not scientists, they're just, most of them are attorneys or business opportunists, they wouldn't know any better about it.
You are aware that there has been a report, which you are going to be researching to see if it's accurate or not, that right behind this vaccine mandate, we have heard that there is an effort to mandate psychiatric medications.
Right. I found there's a bill that Richard Penn is the sponsor of. It's a bill, SB1161. But I haven't been able to read the entire bill through. But this would essentially waive federal regulations concerning psychiatric drugs, but related to Medicaid law, but targeting it to foster work. Okay. It would almost be mandatory for any foster care of 16 beds or older.
Isn't it amazing as abusive of the entire foster care system is in the United States, and California has one of the worst reputations for allowing abuse of children in foster care. Now they would even contemplate giving mandatory psychiatric medications to kids there. We will investigate that as information becomes available. Richard Gale, thank you.
We're out
of time, everyone. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more information tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.